the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Carolyn Rosenblatt. Now, she is an author and attorney, also a columnist for Forbes, and author of a series of different books, The Boomer's Guide to Aging Parents. She's co-author of The Guide to Elder Mediation, Succeed with Senior Clients, and her latest book, Aging and Incapacity. And we're going to be talking about similar topics today. And Jim, as we were getting ready to do this show, the German bond rate, well, the bond rates went down below zero. I had seen them when they hit zero and into negative territory. So preparing for retirement in this kind of environment is getting to be much, much bigger challenge as every day rolls by.
Yeah, it was amazing because we did a show last week talking about how we were operating in really, John, probably the most unusual environment economically and also from an investment perspective in my entire lifetime. And we talked about how bond yields, both on British gilts and German bonds, have gotten to be the lowest they've ever been in human recorded history. Interest rates were actually higher when Hammurabi was king of Mesopotamia. So, I mean, that just goes to show you, and British gilts are the lowest they've been since the Bank of England was founded back in 1694. So that just gives you a little bit more of the background, how difficult it is for individuals that are, let's say, living off income now that they're retired.
Well, I guess this is really the screwy part about it because, you know, here we are. We are at the lowest interest rates in history, as far as we know, and it's in negative territory. And what that means is, you know, you're paying the central bank or your bank to make an investment, basically, is what you're doing. I'm making an investment on which I expect to make a return, but I'm going to have to pay you instead of getting something back on it. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, the interesting thing about it is over 2.5 decades, we've always watched Japan. They've had low interest rates. And of course, in Japan now, they have negative interest rates as they do in Europe. And that's what happened this week. Even German bond yields actually went negative. Swiss bond yields have been negative. But now, John, it's not just that individuals are dealing with no interest. Now they're dealing with, if I keep my money at the bank or if I invest in a bond, I actually have to pay the bank or the government money. So it is a totally different world than the world, John, that your parents or my parents grew up in. Because as we've talked so many times on this program, the three-legged stool of retirement has always been a pension plan, Social Security, and personal savings. If we look at what has happened to all three of those, they're all being altered and changed. I mean, defined benefit plans, as we talk about the only place left that you're going to find defined benefit plans are with government. And believe me, in the next decade, government defined benefit plans are also going to go away. I hate to tell that to you, folks, but state after state, city after city is going and becoming bankrupt due to pensions. It's just unsustainable. But the three-legged tools have always been pension, Social Security, which they have modified. They've pushed back the age for people like you and I, John, where we have to wait to age 66. The Gen Xers will have to wait to age 67. And mark my words, whoever the next president is, they're going to push that retirement age for full benefits of Social Security to age 69. And it's only natural because of the issues that we'll be talking about in terms of longevity here. But one of the things that's going to happen, they will have to modify Social Security. The Social Security Disability Trust Fund has been in trouble, which is why they had to modify it in last year's budget plan. Medicare is running into issues, which is why since 2005, depending on your income, you can pay 3 times the amount for your Medicare premiums based on your income. And we know that Social Security is only going to cover 60% of your medical expenses, so you're going to have good supplemental insurance. And John, Social Security, as you know, or Medicare, will not cover long-term care issues, God forbid, if you live long enough, and one of you ages. And then the other issue, the third-legged stool of retirement has always been savings. But now we're looking at the lowest interest rates in history. I mean, literally, folks, we are living through historical times because history is being made in the financial markets. We did a show 1 week ago talking about the lowest rates that we had seen in Europe. And now, as low as those rates were last week, they hit historic lows this week by rates going negative. Imagine buying a 10-year German government bond and you, the lender, have to pay the German government interest on the bonds that you loan them money. It's almost an upside-down, topsy-turvy world, but it is altering retirement in a way we've never thought before. So the whole issue of retirement, whatever you've been thinking, whatever you've been planning on, you better start thinking differently because it's a whole new different world. And that three-legged stool, parts of it are there, but you're going to have to learn how to reconstruct it so you don't end up dying broke or end up living with your children and becoming a burden to them as so many parents. John, I don't know what's like you, but a lot of the new housing developments here are making provisions for multiple families living in the same house. We're seeing this all over here, at least around where we live in the new communities that are going up.
Well, we actually did that here ourselves when we added on a section for our parents, because we thought that would have to happen here as well. And I've got a solution to that. I'm just going to move to the moon. I don't think I'll have trouble there, and I'll probably avoid most of all the problems here. But for those of you who can't move to the moon, the other thing is really compounding issues is that due to medical science and the fact that people are living better lifestyles during their younger years, they're living longer, which oftentimes raises issues of long-term care and how you're going to survive over that period of time, not even just assuming that you're okay during that period of time, that you're going to be living longer.
Social Security just released the new longevity tables or mortality tables for 2016. And John, every single year, life expectancy is increasing. Now, when they put Social Security into place in 1933, the average male was living to age 65. Now, I'm going to throw some numbers at you folks and just listen to this. And it just goes to show you, basically, retirement has been elongated by almost 20 to 25 years. Now, if you are a male, age 65, your life expectancy is 83 years old. It's actually 82.7, but I'm rounding this off. If you're a woman, it's 85 years. There's roughly about a 3-year difference between men and women. You go to age 70, and you're going to see some interesting things happen. At age 70, a male lives to age 84 is the life expectancy, a woman 86. At age 75, life expectancy for a male is 86. It's almost 88 for a woman. At age 80 for a man, his life expectancy is 88 years. It is almost 90 years for a woman. And at age 85, a man's life expectancy is 91. It's 92. And it's interesting, John, from about age 70 to, let's say, 85, the longer a man lives, the gap between a husband and wife begins to narrow. The longevity gap begins to narrow. So by age 85, it's about a year difference between the two. So that 3-year age longevity for a woman over a man narrows as a man ages. So I guess if you get by age 70, you're expected to live longer. But here's some interesting statistics. You will spend between 20 and 25 years in your retirement. And that's going to create problems because you're going to have to draw on your assets over a longer period of time. And later on, it's more than likely the odds are close to 30, 40, 50%. We'll talk more about this with my guest right afterwards. One of you is going to end up in a retirement home, or even worse, both of you will end up in a retirement home where the cost could be $75,000, $80,000 a year. So one of the issues that is altered, I mean, the positive is people are living longer. They have more healthy lifestyles. They're more able to do things. But as a result of living longer, you're running into having those assets not only last a longer period of time, but as a result of living longer, your medical expenses are going to go up dramatically. You are going to shell out of your own funds anywhere from $230,000 to $250,000 per couple for out-of-pocket medical expenses throughout your retirement years. And it's the one figure, John, that most people don't account for in their retirement plan. They don't account for living longer, and they don't account for these medical expenses that they're going to be shelling out. There's a myth that's developed. Oh, I just get on Medicare and they pay for everything. I hate to tell you, they don't. And especially, they don't pay for long-term care. They'll pay for about 30 days in a long-term care facility if you have a stroke or something major. But that's it. After 30 days, folks, it's out of your own pocket.
You know, and it's not just longevity, Jim, because look at the abuse. I'm going to call it that. Look at the abuse we investors have been through in the last 15 years. We've been through two bear markets, a major crash, the lowest interest rates in history, as you mentioned earlier in this segment here. And as a result of that, you can't earn something just simply by putting your money in savings and being frugal. You have to do something with it. And then after the crash, people were really reluctant to do anything with it.
First of all, I mean, if you take a look at in the 80s and 90s, they were really the golden years for investors. The stock market was going up every single year. And we had a 20-year bull market. Interest rates in the 80s were double digits. So, I mean, you could keep your money in a bank and make double digits and get free Vegematic and a toaster. Even though Greenspan brought down interest rates, you could still get high single digits. In fact, in 2007, you could still get 5 or 6%. 5 or 6% today, the only place you can get 5% is a junk bond, because sovereign bond yields, even in the United States, which are some of the highest interest rates in the globe right now, hard to believe the 10-year treasury is down to 1.6%. And believe it or not, when you compare that to negative interest rates in Europe and Japan, our own treasuries almost sound like junk bond yields. So we've had two bear markets. A bear market in the early part of the decade where the market lost 45%. We had a second bear market that began in 2007. And understand this, from the year 2000 to the year 2013, you made zip, and I mean zero, in the stock market. So it's not just the fact that Greenspan brought interest rates down to the lowest levels we'd ever seen. And today, we are now living history, literally, with the lowest interest rates ever recorded in human history. They were actually higher under Hammurabi or Egyptian pharaohs than they are today. They were higher when the Bank of England was founded in the 17th century than they are today. So that is one of the reasons why it's not only become more difficult, because there's two things, John, out of that retirement stool that have been altered. People no longer have defined benefit pension plans, and the savings and returns on investments have been changed dramatically. About the only thing that is left is Social Security, and that's going to be altered. It's going to be pushed back. So, you know, here we are this week. We're doing this show, and we have some of the lowest interest rates. I'm just reading this, and folks, this could be lower by the time you're listening to this program. In Germany today, interest rates on German bonds, these are 10-year yields, are 0.01. That's one basis point negative. Last week, I talked about we hit records on British gilts. On the day we're doing the show, British gilts have gotten down to 1.14. French 10-year bonds are only 0.4%. Remember all those problems we had in the pig countries in Italy, Spain, Portugal, when you were getting 9-10%? Italian bond yields are 1.5%, actually lower than treasuries. Spanish bond yields are 1.5%, lower than treasuries. In Netherlands, 10-year bond yields are at 0.25%. Portugal, which has major problems. Heck, I guess that maybe the only place you can get a decent return is Greece. In Greece, you can get 8%. In Switzerland, you pay the government a negative 0.6%. So if you loan the Swiss government money, you actually pay them a little more than 0.5%. And in U.S., yields are down to 1.6%. Canadian bond yields, even though their currency is depreciated against the U.S., 10-year Canadian bond yields are 1.1%. The only place that you can get something decent, go to Brazil, where their currency has lost 30%. You can get a little over 12%, but then you'll lose 30% of your principal. So, John, the net gist of this is savers are being penalized. So two of the tools that have been counted on in retirement no longer exist. You're going to have to go to alternatives if you intend to survive and make it through your retirement.
You know, maybe we should illustrate this in a way that people can understand, Jim, because a lot of times we talk about negative interest rates. Is there any way to illustrate it, dramatize it? Because they're talking about basis points all the time. So, you know, there are X basis points on a particular investment or interest rate. How does that work?
Let me put it in terms that people will relate to, and that is the income you're going to receive from your investments. And this was really dramatized when I interviewed Professor Robert Merton from Harvard. And he's a Nobel laureate, and he's written a piece called The Next American Crisis is a Crisis in Retirement. And what he was basically saying is that in the year 2000, if you had $1 million, now most of you, if you're thinking, gosh, everybody would love to have $1 million, be a millionaire. Let's face it, a millionaire today doesn't mean the same thing it did 16 years ago. 16 years ago on $1 million, you got $70,000 to $80,000 income in something completely safe like U.S. Treasuries. Fast forward 16 years in the year 2016, the day we're doing this program, if you had $1 million and invested it in a 10-year treasury, you would only get $16,000. Now, if you had invested it in a 2-year treasury, I don't even want to tell you the amount of money that you would have to have. I mean, let's put it this way. If you were worth $100 million, now that's a lot of money. On $100 million, your annual income would only be $1.6 million. That's it. And if you had $100 million and you invested it in 2-year treasuries, your income would only be $200,000 to $300,000 a year. Can you imagine, John, being worth $100 million and you're saying, I don't want to take any risk. I don't want to risk my principal. I want it completely safe. I want it at the bank. On $100 million, you'd only make $200,000. Well, actually, if you had $100 million at a bank, you wouldn't make any money at all. They would probably charge you interest to keep it on deposit.
Jim, I'm just short $300 million. Can you loan it to me?
Well, yeah, if I had Daddy Warbucks.
I tell you what, let's frame something a little more realistic here for a lot of people who are going to be retired. Say I'm going to retire, and in addition to Social Security, I want $3,000 a month income. How am I going to generate that in today's market?
Well, let me put it in a perspective. Now, let's assume that you're willing to risk and invest your money for 10 years because, I mean, you're only going to get roughly about 0.25% if you're in, let's say, a 1-year treasury. So let's say you were willing to take a risk. I'll loan the government money for 10 years. You're going to get 1.6%. If you wanted to generate $3,000 a month income, you're going to need $2.25 million. If you want to generate $4,000 a month income, that's $48,000 a year, you're going to need $3 million. To generate $5,000 a month, you need $3,750,000. And if you want to generate $6,000 a month, you're going to need $4.5 million. And John, you know, anybody living in New York, California, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month is not a lot of money. I mean, you're not living in Beverly Hills with $3,000 a month, and yet you're going to have $2.25 million in order to get by.
You know, when you think about it, for a lot of Americans, that's really flabbergasting, and it drives home the point why Americans are now having to plan on including work in their retirement.
Well, it is, and it's also impacting the unemployment rate because so instead of retiring at age 62 or 65, which means when you retire, that means your job now becomes available for the company to hire somebody else. Well, a lot of people are staying on because they simply can't retire. The reason is it's a combination. They don't have the pension plans their parents had, and they can't earn a decent return on their investments. We just talked about, in many cases, we're getting to the point in the next recession, not only are you not going to get anything on your savings or in the bond market, you're going to end up paying the government money to loan them money, which is why the sale of safes and cash stored under the mattress is a growing issue for central bankers because they've gone to negative interest rates instead of forcing people to spend money. In Japan, they're going out and buying safes, and that's one of the reasons why the gold market is doing so well right now.
So how does this alter the landscape as you perceive it? Because obviously, if they're going to get higher returns, they're going to move themselves into a higher risk category. And that was always something that people looking for retirement were trying to avoid doing. Remember the good old days of government guaranteed instruments that would get you a good yield. But this is, again, a whole different environment.
The risks are changed dramatically, and a lot of people just don't think of it in the way they did during their working career. I mean, during the working years, most affluent people buy life insurance to protect themselves financially against uncertain timing of death. So you want to make sure you have the assets if you haven't accumulated them. They also, you know, go out and acquire disability insurance in case they get in an accident or something happens. They also have the option to stay invested. In other words, you're not drawing on your investments. And since you're adding to your 401k each month, you can ride out a market downturn. For example, in the year 2000 to 2002, if you were putting money into your 401k plan, well, every single month as shares went down, your monthly contributions bought more shares. So you didn't need the money. You could ride out the bear market. Also, you know, you're generally protected against inflation because generally people get some kind of pay raise, or let's say their careers advance, they get promotions. And also their employers usually cover their health insurance to protect them against major healthcare costs. But that is changing with Obamacare. A lot of companies are dropping some of their insurance or making their employees pay for more of it. But generally, you know, your employer is going to pay for a part of it. Now, when you retire, most people don't think about the uncertainty of death. What happens if you don't live that long, or if you haven't chosen the right Social Security option? They don't protect themselves against the risk of, let's say, incapacity, one of them going into a long-term care facility. And quite honestly, when they're in retirement, they can't afford to ride out a bear market. Imagine if you retired in the year 2008 and then saw 45% reduction in the value of your assets. It's one of the reasons why you're seeing a lot of the individuals that teach retirement at universities are recommending annuities, which we're going to get into, because you can't afford to ride out a downturn of a bear market and see almost half your assets disappear at the beginning of your retirement. You'll never recover. It's not only that, as we talked about, one of the other issues is you're going to live 20 to 25 years in retirement, so you're going to be dealing with inflation. And I hate to say it, but healthcare inflation is the worst for retirees. It's running at 6 to 8% a year, especially more since Obamacare has been passed. It's been rising at high single digits a year. And most individuals, as we age, we know, you know, our body starts to break down. We get sicker. We get disease. So healthcare costs begin to rise as well. And so these are the issues, John, in terms of how risks change. And people just don't have a plan because when they were working, the risks were different. They were mitigated by work. They could ride out bear markets. The employer provided medical insurance. And all of a sudden now they're retired and their world changes.
You know, and what is amazing, you have a life expectancy that's rising. A lot of people are going to live through their 90s, even into their hundreds. People just don't plan.
You know, it's interesting. I have a client. There's a retirement facility, a retirement home close to our office, and we have quite a few clients there. It houses about 500 individuals, John. Out of 500 individuals, 190 individuals are in their 90s, and they have 10 people at that retirement home that are actually over age 100. Now, listen to this. If you are a man age 65 and you're in good health, you have a 25% probability that you could live to age 92 or longer. If you're a woman, you could live to age 94 and longer. So there's already a 25% probability. And, you know, I don't know about you, John. I mean, look at the world that we're living in now. I mean, if you and I, we started doing this show in 2001, neither you nor I could have predicted that we would have been talking about the lowest recorded interest rates in human history, or that you would actually pay the government to loan them money. I mean, imagine that. John, none of us would have seen this 16 years ago. So how do you know what's going to be out there 25 years from now? And that's why I think it's very important that individuals plan. And you got to change how you think about planning. It's not the assets that you should be thinking about. In other words, what's my number? The most important thing is, what's your income?
Well, I know you've talked to Professor Wade Pfau here on the program about annuities. Robert Merton, Nobel laureate from Harvard, is very much in favor of this area. The annuities are becoming more popular. Is this one solution to this dilemma which we have outlined?
It is one solution. I mean, if you don't have the assets, you're going to have two choices. One, actually you have three. You may have to move someplace else and cut your lifestyle dramatically. Secondly, you just end up working longer. Or three, turning part of your assets into your own private pension. And quite honestly, John, we're going back to what was in place 25, 30 years ago when individuals worked for companies. Then, you know, after spending 30 years with a company, you usually ended up with a pension that covered 60, 70% of, let's say, your salary while you worked, and that pretty much covered your main living expenses, and then the rest you relied on Social Security and savings. And what is happening now is why annuities are becoming more important is, I mean, if you take a look at your expenses in retirement, there are basic necessities. That's what does it cost you to live? Either your rent, you know, money you pay to a retirement home, your groceries, your utility, your Medicare premiums, all of those things. Those are your basic necessities. And then there's everything else. The vacations, the hobbies, you know, the occasional every 5, 6 years buying a new car. And then the one you hope you never face is long-term care. And we have advocated, if you've listened to the program, the only thing that we have found, and I've been doing this for over 35 years now, is to really break your budget down into basic necessities and let's call it everything else, and medical. So there's three things. And what you want to do is make sure you have enough income coming in every month now until the last of you passes on for the rest of your life, so you don't outlive that. In other words, you need to create some form of stability, of steady income that isn't dependent on what Janet Yellen's going to do, isn't dependent on what the Fed's going to do, that comes in every single month, just like the pension plan your parents had. So what you want to do is target your income to cover your basic needs and make sure that that never runs out. In other words, you don't outlive it. The second thing you need to do is to have something in your portfolio that covers inflationary healthcare costs, because as a retiree, you're going to face a higher retirement inflation rate than the normal working population, because healthcare costs, especially since Obamacare, are going up at 6 to 8% a year. And there's a great probability between the two of you and a husband and wife that one of you will live long enough or long enough to be in a long-term care facility. And so that's one of the reasons why immediate annuities, basically you're giving money to an insurance company and that insurance company is going to send you a monthly check for the rest of your life and that of your spouse. And it's one of the reasons why I've had Professor Wade Pfau, I've had Professor Merton from Harvard. And the reason they like it is, number one, it creates certainty. It gives you that certainty that you used to get when you had a defined benefit pension plan from your employer. And quite honestly, a defined benefit pension plan is nothing other than an annuity. A company puts money aside, and then when you retire, they have a bucket of money, they go to insurance company, and they say, all right, based on your age, what are you going to give this individual based on this pot of money? That's what a defined benefit pension plan is, and annuity, immediate annuity, is the same thing. The reason they're popular, it's certain. It's predictable. You can't outlive it. And it's very similar to the defined benefit plans that people in government have, or the old days in corporate America. And so, John, that's why you really have to think differently today. Everybody in our industry has been teaching people, what's your number? There's a number that you have to have when you're retired. I hope when I show you how little it buys today, you have to start thinking of income, and you also have to start thinking about longevity. There is a great probability that between you and your wife, you are going to live 20 to 25 years, and a 25% chance you'll be living into your 90s or longer.
As you're summing it up here, you have a number of choices, and you're pretty well limited to this right now. Number one, you don't retire. That's number one. Okay. Or two, a slight modification of that, you retire, but you work longer into your retirement, either full or part-time. Number three, you can just simply say, well, I've got X amount of planned income and I'm just going to risk that I won't live that long. And you wind up consuming all of your assets to spending them down to zero to being broke. And remember, that doesn't take into account medical issues you might have. Or finally, number four, doing some planning so you have income that will be there when you need it and won't be as subject to all of these other things that you have been discussing. And to test all of this, let's put this into practicality and look at this week's case study. As we're always on the program, our case studies are based upon real life experiences of clients, but we change their names to protect privacy and related issues. So who are our guinea pigs this week, shall we say?
This is the case of Frank and Margaret Clay. Frank is age 68. Margaret is 64. Speaking of longevity, Frank's family has a history of diabetes and he has high blood pressure. But the problem is Margaret has parents that lived into their early 90s and has no current medical condition. So we had the issue of age difference. There was 4 years difference between them. The fact that Margaret's a woman, add another 3 years for longevity with women outliving men. So there was almost a 7 or 8 year longevity gap between Frank and Margaret. Added to the fact that Frank had medical issues where Margaret did not. Now, they both lived in Virginia. Frank at age 68 and his wife at age 64. Frank was considering retiring due to the long hours and wife would like to also retire. He's a lawyer. Margaret is a paralegal. They work in the same firm. They want to travel, take some adventures while, you know, they're both in fairly good health. And they also want to spend time with their children and three grandkids. Now, Frank will start Social Security when he retires. They have no other income sources for retirement other than the assets they saved personally. They had some rental properties that they bought and sold for a profit, so they had a lot of money in cash. They were thinking of buying a second home in Florida to be closer to where their grandchildren were, but I basically said, you know what, that is going to be stretching a little bit, especially when you think about longevity. Even though Frank had some medical issues, I said, Frank, you know, you can live still into your 80s. And certainly Margaret has a history in her family of living into their 90s. And so basically they had a $1 million home they bought in 2011. They owe $700,000 on it. So that's part of some of the major expenses. They had taxable investments of $1,320,000. Frank's IRA was $740,000 and Margaret's IRA was worth $423,000. So they had basically $2,483,000. Here was the problem. Their living expenses were roughly about $120,000 a year, of which $44,000 was their mortgage payment. Frank's Social Security would be $31,000 and Margaret's would be $17,000 a year in 2019. Now, as we talked about this, they both love their home and they love the lifestyle. They do a lot of entertaining. The home is on a golf course. That is one of the ways they relax. They love the community they live in, the friends they've made. They want to stay there. They don't want to change that. They feel they sacrificed a very long time for the kids' activities, putting kids through school. You know, as Frank said, we'd probably have a lot more money today had we not educated our kids well. And they said, basically, it's our time. So ideally, they would like to find a place to stay. And I convinced them that, look, it's just cheaper to rent for a second home. You don't want to be making two house payments. You're already making $44,000 a year on a mortgage payment. So I said, basically, you can rent places. You know, I live in a community where you see a lot of people that come here. We get a lot of people that come here from warm climates like Arizona and Utah. They come here for the summer. They rent condos here. And I go, you can do the same thing. The challenges that we were facing is they would need to withdraw at a rate of almost 5% a year on their assets in order to meet their expenses. The other issue they had is their trust was not updated, and worse, their property was held in their personal names with no liability protection instead of the name of their trust. And as we mentioned earlier, this was really an issue of longevity, which ran especially on Margaret's side. And Frank wanted to make sure that Margaret was protected given their age and also recognizing longevity running on their side. So basically what we did, I said, there's no way that I can earn that kind of money to support your lifestyle in the market. I can't earn it in stocks. I can't earn it in bonds. And so we talked about annuity options, either putting $1 million or $2 million into a annuity. And what we did is we opted to take $1 million and we put it in an annuity, basically, which would give them a monthly income, which would be roughly almost $4,400 a month. About $3,200 of the $4,300 would be tax sheltered, so they wouldn't pay tax. That would produce enough income, roughly about $53,000 a year. Their investment income would be a little over $47,000. Social Security would be $31,000. Basically, our inflation hedge down the road would be Margaret in 4 more years. Basically, she would get Social Security, which would be $17,000. So their total income would be $131,000. That was more than their $119,000 in expenses. And also in 4 more years, their income would be roughly $148,000 once Margaret's Social Security. The rest of it was put in a dividend blue chip portfolio in short-term corporate bonds to keep it safe and produce income. And then we also updated their estate plan. We got their personal residence into the name of their trust. Otherwise, it wouldn't do them much good. And we wanted to delay Margaret's Social Security. We didn't want her taking it now, which she could, but she would get less money. But if she waited to full retirement age, she would get $17,000 a year. That would bring their income up almost to $150,000. But John, here was one area where we created a private pension along with, let's say, short-term bonds that gave them that guaranteed income that would come in that was predictable and certain. And so, in essence, we created their own private pension plan that produced almost $5,000 a month income.
And coming up next, Carolyn Rosenblatt, author, attorney, and Forbes columnist, Aging and Incapacity, looking at the whole issue of senior citizens and some of the legal and financial issues that come with the later years. All of that as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we hear about it every single day. 10,000 Americans are heading into retirement as the baby boomers age. But that retirement brings on difficulty. Elder abuse to even making it through retirement without dying broke. Joining me on the program is attorney, author, and Forbes columnist Carolyn Rosenblatt. Let's talk about some of the issues that are arising today in the kind of retirement market we're seeing. A couple things have changed that. The security of defined benefit pension plans have gone away. We're dealing in an investment market where you're seeing negative, if not zero, interest rates. And what is happening is a lot of individuals are finding that they're ending up taking care of their parents. So let's begin with that. And the issues that this raises is mom and dad age.
Yes, it's certainly becoming more of a problem than it ever was before because people are living longer than they ever have in the history of this country, in the history of the world for that matter. And it's great because everybody thinks longevity is wonderful, but we forget that our health span, that is the number of years that we remain healthy and independent, is not increasing in the same way that our lifespan is increasing. In fact, we're not doing so well with that. So there are more people who have impairments, age-related disabilities, and consequently a need for care. That is hideously expensive, so we've got to devise ways to address that. And families are finding that they have to take on more responsibility than they ever planned on.
One of the things that I think is not incorporated in retirement planning, you think, okay, let's say you made a salary of $100,000 a year, you retire, and maybe with Social Security investments, you're making $60,000, $70,000 a year, you're living retirement. But what people aren't thinking about is the issue that you just raised, because A couple at age 65 could end up spending 20 to 25 years in retirement. And I just read a statistic the other day, Carolyn, that a man age 65 has a 25% probability living into his 90s. Well, we know the older we get, we start running into capacity issues, and we know that we have to pay more and more for medical expenses. And so one of the issues that we're seeing, and the builders here in California are starting to incorporate it, they're making or adding on extra rooms, guest houses, because we're seeing multiple family living in the same residence.
Yes, and it's really the most cost-effective way there is to manage the care of an aging parent. The family must step up and take some responsibility for that. You know, we all live with the great American fantasy, I call it, that we're going to live to be 100, we're going to be 100% capable, and we'll die quietly in our sleep after our 100th birthday party. It's kind of the common myth that we all embrace because we don't want to think about getting old and not being so chipper and capable. But the truth is that about 70% of us are going to need long-term care at some point. And the poorer we are about taking care of our own health, the more likely that is. So families, the adult children of these aging folks, have to step up and do something to help their elders when they begin to fail physically and mentally with problems such as Alzheimer's disease that you mentioned. That affects at least 1 in 3 people who are 85 and up, and it is an age-related risk. So when we have parents who are becoming cognitively impaired or physically impaired or both, which is also often the case, we've got to find a way to take care of them. And shared housing is the best way that there is out there to do that. Because when you look at the average cost of placing someone in even assisted living or a seniors community where there's minimal help, you're looking at costs that exceed the average retirement income that an older person has. When you say maybe they made a salary of $100,000, that far exceeds the national average salary. So when you ratchet those numbers down, even in places where care is less expensive, in a facility like assisted living than it is in California, there's still not enough income to meet that need. So families are stepping up and saying, well, let's bring mom or dad here. And in some cultures, Asian cultures, Latino cultures, it's expected. People plan their lives around that likelihood that they're going to take in their elder or have them live with them in a multi-generation household. But in the greater, more dominant, perhaps, if you want to call it that, American culture, families are very scattered. Mom may live in Florida while the children live in Missouri, or mom may live in California and the children live in New York. And so we see a real problem with the uprooting of the elder because of the need for care. And then the adjustment that the family has to make collectively to try to get together and fit into one another's lives when they have not done that previously. And it creates some conflict.
I've run into issues with clients where, you know, they finally become empty nesters and they think, okay, we can really start saving for retirement now. The kids are all out of the house. They're educated. And then all of a sudden they find themselves taking care of their own parents because their parents didn't plan properly. So it throws this extra burden. Let me bring up an issue that we find sometimes in our practice, and we'll get a call from clients where, let's say you have a situation, mom lives in Florida and the kids live in California. Kids go out to visit mom and they notice that either her mental capacity or mom and dad are doing things that you're saying, you know, there's something wrong going on here. What are the things that we can do to prepare ourselves for that or to keep up? I mean, in other words, if you're living in California and mom and dad are in Florida, how do you know something's going wrong? I ran into an issue where a trust was set up years ago, but the parents basically set up their bank accounts, their investment accounts, in a property they bought completely out of the trust, bypassing their whole estate plan.
Well, part of the difficulty with the scenario that you just mentioned is the failure to have the conversations about what will happen if we lose independence. And again, there is tremendous resistance in our culture to doing that because we are age phobic. We're disabled phobic, we're death phobic, we don't want to talk about these things. And it's unfortunate because then it hits the adult children like a slap in the face when maybe on some holiday or birthday they go out to Florida to visit mom or dad from California and they realize these people are not living in a safe situation. Or they're horrified to see that they haven't been paying their bills and they're stacked up on the table. or they see that the parents have become hoarders and the place is a mess. I could go on because people tell me about these things every day at agingparents.com. So what we advise them is, look, if you're the adult child and you've got parents who are over 65, many of my colleagues who are in their 60s have parents who are in their 80s and 90s. I've got a mother-in-law who's 93, okay? And we need to have these conversations very early. At retirement is a good time. If somebody says, okay, I'm going to retire at 65 or 66, fine. Sit down with the adult children. Let's plan for the future. In the unlikely event that I should become disabled, what would we all do? That would be a good way to open this discussion. And if the parent is unwilling to open the discussion and initiate the subject, then the adult children must do so, because we have to look at the cost of long-term care and how we're going to pay for it, how we're going to handle it ourselves if we can't reach into our funds and pay for it out of pocket. It's terrifying when someone is running out of money and the adult children don't know what to do, because that elder really needs a lot of care. They either can't deliver it themselves or they don't want to give up what their plans were for retirement. It's very, very disruptive in people's lives, but it can be traced back to a failure to plan for this realistic possibility that we may not make it to 100 in perfect health.
You know, there's also the issue, too, as you say, we don't like dealing with these issues. And when you start losing your ability to think clearly, cognitive impairment starts to set in. Many times you may not realize what's going on. So unless there's somebody that really picks up on this, either a physician on a doctor visit or children visiting parents and really picking up on, hey, things aren't working right. What about the issue of having the proper estate planning documents? For example, if you don't have a durable power of attorney where somebody can step in, the problems that you run into court-appointed conservatorships, which can make matters even worse and more complicated.
These are terrible outcomes, having to go to court. Terrible outcomes. And again, this all goes back to having the conversation. If you are an adult child, let's say you're a boomer, okay? There are only 73 million of us. I'm talking to my colleagues here, okay? We have to approach the parents in our lives or the grandparents, whoever it is, the loved ones who are aging, and say, look, we need to look at what's going to happen if you can't manage by yourself. Let's talk about your estate plan. Do you have someone who is appointed as the power of attorney? Is that the right person? Can you trust them? Do you have documents that are current? But I also, Jim, blame attorneys, because they only do the estate plan, and far too many of my brethren lawyers fail to look at what happens if the elder does not realize that he or she is impaired. Look, the typical estate plan has a trust and a will. The property, the house, whatever is in a trust. There is a trustee or two. Usually that's mom and dad, all right? One of them becomes impaired, the other is supposed to take over. But if they're both near the same age, both parents can be impaired at the same time. And the successor trustee, who might be an adult child and usually is supposed to take over when the parent becomes incapacitated. And in most estate planning documents, that is spelled out as saying, when a doctor or two doctors declare that they are incapacitated. If they think they're fine, they're not going to go to the doctor. They're not going to go get evaluated. This is a real problem. And I am always pleading with my brethren in the law who do estate planning documents to address this possibility. There are ways that a lawyer can plan for that and have the succession, if we can call it that, pass automatically at a certain point to the successor trustee, the adult child, or the appointed person, if the elder refuses to be evaluated for capacity. So that is a problem that exists really everywhere, because so many people who develop cognitive decline do not recognize any longer that they are impaired. The very part of the brain, and I'm speaking as a nurse here because I spent 10 years as a registered nurse. I visited thousands of elders at home. The part of the brain that is affected by Alzheimer's disease, for instance, the most common form of dementia, is such that our reasoning and cognitive abilities are damaged. Our logic, our ability to process information is damaged or destroyed. We can't tell that we're impaired if we have that ailment. Very often we don't know. It's not just denial, although it could be. It's really an inability to see it. So we have a real problem there in families because the elder thinks they're fine and the kids know they're not.
Let's talk about something that's related to this and something that we're seeing more and more, and that's elder abuse. I have a situation right now where there's four kids in the family. Mom gets Alzheimer's. names one of her kids as successor trustee. The problem is he's unemployed. And what he begins to do is drain large amounts of money out of the account, taking out, paying himself $5,000, $6,000 a month, unbeknownst to his other three siblings. And so we're starting to see more and more of this happen. And unfortunately, unless you've made the effort to plan for it, we're seeing this more and more and more.
Very common scenario, unfortunately. And it's quite a stereotype these days where we see the son, after dad passes, abusing mom because son is for some reason a ne'er-do-well or greedy or selfish or has a substance abuse problem, whatever the reasons are, it's a crime of opportunity. And when I say crime, I'm talking about under California law. We don't have very good laws in every state in this union. In this state where you and I are, Jim, we can prosecute an abuser for the crime of elder abuse and undue influence, which means manipulating that person, but because of one's relationship of trust. That goes along. But in other states, we are casting about to get better laws, and there's been a resistance on the part of legislatures to pass them. In the meantime, no matter where you are, if you see a sibling abusing a parent, we have to step up and make every possible effort to address that before the elder becomes impoverished. Because a greedy person who steals from a parent is not stopped by anyone other than family members in most cases. Even law enforcement doesn't get involved because most of these cases of elder abuse are not reported to Adult Protective Services or law enforcement. And we're talking about $64 billion a year stolen from elders in this country. $64 billion. Most of the abusers are family members. Next, caregivers. Next most common abusers. And guess who's third, Jim? It's professionals.
It's absolutely amazing that we're seeing more and more about it. Why do you think there have not been more protective laws, number one? And number two, what do you do if you're in a family? In this case, one child is named trustee. And of course, the other children may not have information in terms of financial statements, expenses. So they may have no idea what this one child is doing to mom's estate, basically draining the money out and basically depriving them of their own inheritance.
Exactly right. If the adult children are beneficiaries under a trust or a will, they have a right to hire an attorney and to go into court and demand an accounting for what is happening to the estate at the hands of the person who is the appointed successor trustee. If Sonny Boy is in charge of the money and he's ripping off the estate, the adult children who are siblings and co-heirs of that estate can get an accounting. But again, they've got to ante up with the dollars to hire an attorney to go in and demand that accounting. They'll get an order because they have a right. They'll get an order from the court so that that person has to disclose what's happened. But again, it's very frustrating because a lot of times the thieving adult child keeps no record. And, you know, you've got to spend money to subpoena their bank records to see what they've done with it. And they've enriched themselves at the expense of everybody else. And they get away with it a lot. It's a very, very frustrating part of the law because we have trouble with enforcement. We have trouble with reporting. Jim, I have looked a 93-year-old woman in the eye. This person still had testamentary capacity. That is the ability to appoint a trustee. She did not have financial capacity, and there is a significant difference between those two. She could not handle her own funds anymore. Her son was the second person after her, the trustee, and he took over, okay? He was stealing from her. He wanted to uproot her, take her to his house, dump her in a daycare center all day long because he was working all day, and sell her house for his benefit. And, of course, he wanted to charge his mother rent, okay? It was awful.
Wow.
And I looked her in the eye, and I said, we'll call her Mary. Mary, your son is stealing from you. That is a crime under the laws of this state. He's manipulating your money, and he wants to take your house away from you. And she looked at me, and she said, Carolyn, I don't want my son reported, okay?
Mm.
So that speaks to the problem we have. Parents do not want to get their adult children in trouble, no matter how bad they are.
In elder abuse, Carolyn, I wonder if you might address this, is a very serious crime. I mean, you're talking about 4 or 5 years of imprisonment. So, you know, no parent wants to see one of their kids go to prison. And I think this is one of the issues why we see more of it, because parents are reluctant to address this issue.
Yes, they are reluctant. They're reluctant to report it. They're reluctant to address it. We have the phenomenon of the willing victim. They know they are being abused, just as this Mary that I talked about. She knew that her son was doing what was wrong, but she did not want to see him prosecuted. So they refused to report. If someone else reports, they refused to testify. And without sufficient evidence in a court of law, the district attorney is unable to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime occurred. And therefore, we have the continuing problem of abuse that is not punished, that people get away with, or even worse, it's never reported at all.
So, given the issues that we talked about diminished incapacity. We talked about the issue where basically mom and dad, or mom or dad alone, begins to run out of money. So all of a sudden there's a burden placed on the children. We've talked about elder abuse. If you want to avoid these things, what are the steps children should take that have parents that are aging, that want to avoid these issues of diminished capacity, mental capacity, or the fact that mom or dad alone may not have the money to last their remaining lifetime?
Well, it is very important to start communicating about this early, and I describe in my book, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, how to have that conversation. There are suggestions that I make, and they include taking the initiative, looking at all that a parent has by the time they reach retirement age, and plotting out how those assets can be used to keep that parent safe until the end of life. Every financial professional such as you, every financial advisor, no matter what credentials come after their name, has an opportunity to help the parents and the adult children plan for how to use the parent's assets in the most prudent way so that they can last as long as possible. Now, if that includes selling the family home, or being prudent about spending, or working from a budget, fine. Whatever it is, the family needs to be included in the discussion with the financial professional. And this is an area where financial professionals are not expanding their traditional job of just working with the client. They need to invite the adult children into the office or into the conversation so that everyone is aware of what the issues are, how much there is in the estate, what are the best ways to save that so that it will last for the rest of a person's life. And then we need to look realistically about life expectancy. Okay, there are calculators, I'm sure you know, that can be used to tell us about what's realistic. You know, the average life expectancy for a man is somewhere in the 80s, and for a woman in the late 80s. I'm using general terms because it depends a lot on health, and I look at health risks differently because of my nursing background. But, you know, if the person's obese and smokes and has heart disease and diabetes, they're probably not going to live to be 100, but they probably are going to need long-term care. On the other hand, if they're normally healthy and try to watch their weight and get some exercise and take good care of themselves and manage whatever chronic diseases may be present, they probably will live longer than the average life expectancy. So all of those things need to be considered, talked about, budgeted for, and planned about. And if, we discussed at the beginning of our conversation, the plan includes moving a parent in, people need to look at when that would be a good time to do it. They need to plan on how to address the differences between people. They need to look at the interfamilial conflicts that have existed and talk about how they're going to manage those. You know, you don't just plunk your aging parent in your house after being apart for 40 years or more and expect everything to be fine. It isn't always so fine. So there's help with that. There's help with all of these things out there. We offer some of it in our office at agingparents.com, but there are lots of other kinds of help too. And I think financial professionals play a key role in helping people do the planning that they need so that this can go as well as it possibly can.
A final question, Carolyn. Let's just assume that mom and dad have an estate plan. One issue that we see, they might have gotten an estate plan, a trust, wills, and maybe that was done 10 years ago. And, you know, quite honestly, they don't think about it. Family circumstances have changed. Their own net worth might have changed. Health issues. How do kids delicately approach mom and dad and say, mom, dad, you know, to find out, to make sure that everything is updated and in good working order in case something should happen? Because in one issue where we found a trust was set up, but none of the properties were in the trust, investment accounts weren't in the trust. So basically you had a document that was not effective because of what the parents had done. So what would you tell children how they can sort of maybe have a conversation or check up and say, hey, mom, dad, you mind if we check up on the estate plan? Or when was the last time you had this reviewed? Because we know that things change over the years. Goodness, health can change, investments can change, net worth can change, the tax laws change.
Yes, and these are all really good points that you raised, because most people get their estate plan done if they do. Unfortunately, fewer than half of our population even has an estate plan, believe it or not. But for those who do, it's really important to understand that they don't go back to the lawyer every 5 years and say, let's update this. And the lawyers are not initiating this. The client disappears, maybe the lawyer has passed away by the time the client gets to be 80 or 85. So to answer your question, I think it's important for the kids, the adult children, to initiate the conversation. Make it their problem. Mom, dad, I would be feeling really bad if you had a fall or something happened and you had an accident and I didn't know even where to find the money to pay your mortgage or take care of your bill. We need to have this conversation. And if you approach it from the point of view, it's my problem, then the parent is less likely to be intimidated. Another key point. Most parents do not want to become a burden to their children. This is a common theme that most parents, not all, but most parents share, okay? So if you approach it from, say, look, if you don't want to burden me with the struggle that I would have if things were a mess, I really need you to share information with me. I'm not going to try to take your money away from you. I don't want to take advantage of you. I'm not trying to do this so I can put you in a home. That's a terror that many older people feel. You're going to take my freedom away and put me in a home. They're frightened about that, so they need reassurance. This is another important part of the conversation, to give them that reassurance and to say, we need to look at your estate plan to make sure things are in order with the way the law is right now. And if the parent's lawyer did a lousy job, and I'm sorry to say some do, and the estate plan needs to be changed and updated, you had better jump in and do that while the parent still has the capacity to do it. So again, the best times to have these conversations are really early, retirement age, 70, whatever, early birthdays. Don't wait till they're 90. And the parent says, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. You know, I'm going to do that when I get old. Uh-uh. Don't let them get away with that excuse. You have to gently press forward and insist, which is another part of this, because there's a lot of resistance on the part of the aging parent. They're afraid. They don't want to share information. They grew up during the Depression. People didn't talk about money. There's a lot of fear associated with this and fear of loss of control being the key. But I think if we all consider that we're in this together, that we can help each other and our aging parents, we have a far better chance of making their last years dignified and safe. And I think that's really my theme, is I want people to live in a way that's dignified and safe as they age, no matter what their income level is.
Now, Carol, I know you've written, I think your third book is coming out here, which is Succeed with Senior Clients, A Financial Advisor's Guide to Best Practices. Given the issues that we've discussed here this morning, what would you say is the best book that you have that would make this information available and help individuals guide their parents and plan for their parents and avoid the very issues that you and I have discussed today?
I think for families, the best book that I have is The Family Guide to Aging Parents, Answers to Your Legal, Financial, and Healthcare Questions. And that book is available at agingparents.com. It's available on amazon.com. The Family Guide to Aging Parents is set up to help people know what topics to discuss with aging parents, know what things cost, know how to get the help that parents might need, and to prevent abuse of their aging loved ones. Those are sort of the general topics. And as a corollary to that, if there is a financial professional involved, an advisor, in the picture, then the newest book, which is Succeed with Senior Clients, helps the advisor learn those very same things. How to prevent elder abuse, how to protect the client, how to plan for the costs of care, how to help the families have an intrafamilial discussion about the finances of the parent, the client that you have. So those two working together, I think, would make a beautiful outcome. For people who are not financial advisors, who are the lawyers, there's another book, and that's called Working with Aging Clients. That's published by the American Bar Association. And again, it addresses some of the same themes, how lawyers and other professionals can get into the picture of helping keep the aging client safer and facilitate communication between the generations so that we all achieve the best outcome that we can for the oldest people in our society.
Well, listen, Carolyn, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and bringing these issues to light and showing how they can be resolved. If our listeners would like to find out more about this, why don't you give out your website?
Sure. For families, we have agingparents.com. Agingparents.com has been around since 1996. My husband, Dr. Nicole Davis, who is a geriatric psychologist, and I took it over in about 2008. And we have been actively working with families for years now to help them resolve their conflicts and address the issues that we're talking about. We have lots of material there. There are free things. There's a YouTube channel. There are videos, a lot of information to help you get a grip on taking care of aging parents or just getting along with them better. And for professionals, we have aginginvestor.com, which is designed for people like you, Jim, in your field, to help expand the reach that you have with aging clients, so that you can include families and prevent elder abuse and facilitate, once again, the communication issues around finances and planning around retirement.
Give out the website one more time, Carolyn.
For families, agingparents.com, and for financial professionals, aginginvestor.com. And all of the books that I mentioned are available on both sites, and they are also available at amazon.com.
Well, listen, Carolyn, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best, and thanks for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
You know, Jim, we have been doing the programs together since 2001, and during that time, we've seen everything from, my gosh, if I look back at it, we had the bursting of the tech bubble, which really came home to roost then. We had the housing crisis and the subsequent crash that we experienced there. Lowest interest rates now. We have terrorist issues around the world. We've also had some boom markets, some booms in, say, for example, the metals for a while. But we've also been through two bear markets as well, much of which you could not have foreseen. But as you point out with the Clays, with our demonstrating family here this week, all of these problems, no matter what time you're in and what's going on, you can usually solve the problems as long as you have a workable plan. Because at least that gives you a framework off of which to work. And even if you have to make changes to that plan later on, you at least know what the plan is. And as somebody once said, failing to plan is planning to fail. Or in logic, it's called decision by indecision.
And that's what I hope that we can motivate you, because the whole paradigm for retirement planning, John, has really shifted in a major way. You know, it was all about the number. What is the number that you have to retire? And that's the wrong way to think about your retirement. That number means nothing. Just like I told you, how much it would take to produce $3,000 of income. $2.25 million. How many people have $2.25 million to produce $3,000 of income? The thing you have to think about today in retirement is, what is your income going to be? So the focus needs to be on two issues: longevity, the fact that you're likely to live longer, and two, the amount of income that you're going to need to sustain you throughout those retirement years. Well, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, as usual, we've run out of time, but we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. be advised that you invest at your own risk.